James Kirk, commanding the Starship Enterprise. And your name?
I have a few questions first. My people?
72 of your life support canisters are still functioning. And now?
Khan is my name.
Greetings, everyone. Matt here, and welcome to Star Trek Essentials. Our voyage each week, review the very best of the first 50 years of the Star Trek franchise. Joining me, as always, is Pete. Hello, Pete.
Hey, Matt. What's going on? Happy, as always, to beam on over here.
Yeah, I'm excited that we can finally start our voyage here for Star Trek Essentials.
Definitely.
And today, we are talking about the Star Trek original series episode Space Seed. Pete, in case any of the listeners don't know, first tell us a little bit about what has become known as Star Trek, the original series.
Okay, well, of course, this is the one that started it all. We're coming up on nearly 50 years, next couple of years. In 2016, we'll celebrate the 50th anniversary. So we're talking 1966 was the beginning of the original voyage of the Starship Enterprise. Of course, we're really kind of beholden to the fact that there were really two pilots filmed. There was one filmed with an alternate captain, with Captain Pike, that later became fodder for the animated series, and then later on the newer movies by J.J. Abrams. And they did feature Spock. Majel Barrett was the first officer instead. They later recycled much of that original pilot to make an episode with Kirk and shoehorn Pike in to that and everything else. And then there's the pilot as we come to know it for the series that we've come to know, which is Where No Man Has Gone Before, which gets into the whole idea of ESP and cognitive powers like that. There was a lot of buzz that that might be where the J.J. Abrams Star Trek sequel went. People were anticipating that maybe Benedict Cumberbatch was playing a character named Gary Mitchell, a friend of Kirk's from the Academy, who winds up getting these godlike powers. Hot Lips from MASH, I believe, right? Is the girl who is in the who also is in Where No Man Has Gone Before. So that's the original story on the pilots. The show, of course, gathered steam. You know, there's the difference in terms of the way episodes are laid out on disc or on Netflix as opposed to when they aired. You know, and having conversations recently, both with you, Matt, and with others, you know, some people are going to get it. Some aren't. Obviously, you're listening to this because you get it.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, there's kind of been a resetting almost of the episode chronology. First of all, I believe most of your sources, whether it is Netflix or the Blu-rays or the DVDs, they're going to count that first pilot as episode one when you talk about the first season. I know that definitely is the case for Netflix. And also the episodes have been, I'm pretty sure across the board, the episodes have been reordered to broadcast order versus production order, which I personally quibble with just because you know, like when you watch Where No Man Has Gone Before, there's a certain, it clearly is in between the first pilot, the Cage, and then kind of what comes after that, because they make some tweaks after the second pilot. But it is what it is. You know, it's Great God Paramount doing what they need to do. So for the record, Space Seed is from the first season of the original series, and it's now counted as the 23rd episode of the season when you count the first pilot. So if you're rewatching from an older source, it might be the 22nd episode. I'll mention too that this is going to be an analysis episode. That's also a reminder that some weeks, like next week, we'll be doing commentary tracks for some of these essential episodes.
All righty. And if you want to open hailing frequencies, you can always feel free to share episode feedback at any time. Our Twitter is @podcaststartrek. Fairly easy to remember. And the listener line is area code 412-447-1701. And fans of the show and Star Trek shouldn't have a hard time remembering those last four digits.
And luckily, we have an automated Uhura who will answer that 24/7. So you could leave a message up to 3 minutes to be heard on the podcast if you want. If you want to send an email, it's StarTrekEssentials@gmail.com. And you can leave a comment on the webpage, StarTrekEssentials.blogspot.com, or even find us on iTunes. With that, Pete, should we blast off from the 1990s and actually get into this episode?
Yes, of course.
All right. Well, I think one place to start, just jumping right in, is for all the high ideals that Star Trek offers us, and for all the delivery of this greatest of villains, and even I think towards the end of our conversation, we'll be talking about how this villain is kind of in contrast to what Gene Roddenberry thinks humanity can be at its best.
In contrast?
Indeed. On the other end of the spectrum from all that, we kind of have the issue of gender in this episode. Simply put, it's not hidden at all, the fact that Lieutenant Marla MacGyvers is gobsmacked by the sight of Khan as he's being defrosted. And it's not exactly the best kind of picture for gender equality, because Kirk does his share of bedding the babes, but it's never kind of on a mission, and she's just, she is committing mutiny. Yes, it's kind of glossed over. Oh, it's because she has this appreciation of the 20th century man, but she's just basically there going, awooga to him.
Well, you say this as if the issue of sexism in Star Trek hasn't been an issue lately.
I guess that's true. To go from Marla MacGyvers to Alice Eve in her brassiere and pantaloons in Star Trek Into Darkness. Yeah, I guess that's a fair point.
I mean, listen, she serves the purpose here. We get into the historian aspect and, she knows about that time and everything. It's a plot device. Could her handling have been more in line of, say, some of the stronger female roles we get throughout the original series? It could have. Again, by contrast, it wouldn't have worked there. Khan breaking down an already strong-willed, female crew member, what would that have accomplished? And in a hour running time, less than that with commercials and everything, I just think too much going on to try to do that. His whole thing is this Svengali-like hold over her, and he gets her to help mutiny. And I think it's needed to be that way. Is it at times played a little campily? Absolutely. But Khan plays campily to begin with in both, this episode and, a little lesser so in the film itself.
You use the word Svengali, and I think that is a fair point, particularly kind of in light of, some of the more recent goings on in our world, and not even necessarily, kind of 21st century type stuff. I'm thinking, some of these, like in the late 90s, reference to the Star Trek 1990s intended, but late 1990s, there was the comet cult, they all committed suicide. They're going to ride.
Oh,
the
Haley
comet
Bopp. Absolutely. Yeah. Man. They're going to shed their containers. I mean, with the tennis shoes, but and I get that comparison, but they weren't exiled that, you know what I mean?
True. I guess I'm just saying, like, yes, this episode mines gender stereotypes for to kind of get to, like, oh, he's such a magnetic personality that she will, you know, she will drop uniform in order to facilitate him. I guess I'm just saying, if you take it out of a male-female attraction, it's within the realm of our world where there can just be these magnetic personalities that people follow, and people will follow to the ends of the earth.
Well, that point, I think, is wonderfully said, Matt, because he was like that, you know, on Earth. He was the leader of these supermen. And then for him to gather that hold quickly on her, again, speaks to his character, to that machismo, to that persuasive power, both the intellect and the brutality that he possesses, and what makes him, you know, a worthy foil to Kirk. You know, Kirk inspires, I would say, and really kind of engenders, you know, cooperation. Khan demands you follow.
Well, and I mean, with that, let's talk a bit more about Khan himself. And Pete, I'll ask you this. Is he the greatest of Star Trek TV villains?
Hands down, he's the greatest Star Trek villain that's ever existed. And, you know, there was a recent poll, I can't remember where it came out, of the top 50 greatest villains ever. And he made that as well. And I was reflecting in my head, you know, who would I put if I could pick three? And he made my list of three. It's no wonder you know, and initially I went to say that it would be fool's gold, but it's actual gold that, you know, the writers for the J.J. Abrams Star Trek sequel, it was too big a temptation to resist, to not be able to play with Khan. And I know, you know, feathers were ruffled as far as changing ethnicity and, you know, how do you change things that happened before the alternative, you know, the alternate universe was created and everything like that. And then, of course, there was the horrible and really kind of, you know, I guess I risk branding myself in the eyes of or the ears of people who are listening to this. But at the Star Trek Las Vegas convention, where they named Star Trek Into Darkness the worst of all of the existing Star Trek films, most likely in large part to its inclusion, its decision to go with Khan, I think was really kind of harsh. He's the Joker for Star Trek. He's a villain that demands inclusion, whatever universe you're talking about. And his backstory is compelling, and he's compelling. And as a writer, you know, how could I possibly resist that? How could you resist that? How could they resist that? And I think the Cumberbatch, in terms of the performance he brought, you know, and a worthy successor to one Ricardo Montalban.
Well, you know, as I was watching the episode, I couldn't help but think, you know, when they're on the Botany Bay.
Yes.
when they're on it, I kind of kept saying to myself, all right, let's just everything that you see here, minus the Enterprise crew, minus Ricardo Montalban's face, you know, slash, you know, presence, then, you know, add Benedict Cumberbatch, everything else is the same. If we just allow ourselves the recasting of Khan and the removal of the Enterprise crew, then whoever found them, albeit kind of early compared to the original timeline, whoever found the Botany Bay would have walked onto this exact same setting. And is it slightly incongruous because it's a clearly inexpensive set? You know, I mean, Star Trek never had super duper sets consistently, but this was a one scene set. But there's just kind of that, like, yeah, just imagine, you know, Lieutenant Jones is the one there who's waking up in this exact same room, who's waking up a Benedict Cumberbatch Khan. Speaking of the comparison of the two actors, certainly Benedict Cumberbatch, you know, handsome fella and all that. I just, particularly in the scene where Khan is kind of wearing that strange, you know, over the shoulder bathing suit, then netting, you know, because yes, it's future 1990s garb. Yes. I mean,
I imagine it to be like the packing material that some of my Amazon.com packages arrive in inside. Like he's being protected like that. It's like egg crate-y. That's because it kind of looks like that.
Indeed.
It's like bubble wrap.
But I mean, Ricardo Montalban, I mean, what a physique. And just, you know, perhaps we can forgive McGivers a little bit, but I mean, he just nails the performance. And yes, you made reference to hubbub over re-ethnizing the role for the movie. And let's not forget, you know, in the mighty Ricardo Montalban Khan is, you know, an Indian guy played by a Mexican actor.
Exactly. And between what you mentioned about the set and the ethnicity there, it's so apocryphal even there that I give them a lot of credit for not bowing to the temptation of, well, we got to say he had facial reconstruction. And I know a lot of people have since gone back and, you know, I know we're talking a lot about Star Trek in the Darkness, but I think in light of that film's release and this original episode that spawned all that, I think all of this is interrelated. I think it all really bears out on the discussion. And, you know, for them to not bow to that temptation to, oh, let's make him Indian or let's get an Indian actor or everything like that, and to not address it, I think did a better job than going into heavy detail. No, wait, this is what happened. And I know people have gone to the extent to say, well, maybe, you know, Khan is a title. It's not a name. So maybe they woke up another one of the guys. You know, Matt, I was listening to one of our PH Geek pop culture podcasts the other night from when we watched the first, 9 minutes of Star Trek Into Darkness back in December when it was in IMAX. And, you know, of course, we were dissecting all the little details we had been given then, and we still hadn't been told, you know, who Cumberbatch was playing and everything. And the name we eventually got was John Harrison. And actually on set, the name John Erickson was used again and again and again. And if you pay attention when you watch Space Seed, Erickson is the name of one of the other Supermen.
And oh, wow.
They went in digitally when Harrison is said in the film to change the way people's mouths looked to get it to say Harrison.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, so they went and again, they have to build up the hype, and we know how Abrams works and everything there. You know, it's part of what Hollywood is today, particularly with his production company, you know, and the idea of mystery and pulling people into it. But, you know, I thought they handled it well. And again, all of this comes back. We're not talking about any of that if it weren't for this man, Ricardo Montalban, a guy who owned it here, who later got the gig. Well, Love Boat led to Fantasy Island, if I remember correctly. It was spun off of that.
Okay, that sounds familiar.
And, you know, just owned it as Mr. O'Rourke. And I remember as a little kid, you know, going to see a Star Trek movie where Mr. O'Rourke is the bad guy, and he friggin' owned it there. You know, you want to talk about physique, talk about a man in his late 50s, early 60s, completely ripped up, with the open chest thing going on there in 1980 too, you know, and just owning that. So the idea that he would be this, you know, this Superman, this leader and everything he represented, you know, he sold it from the first moment he's revived and the games that he plays, the cat and mouse with Kirk, even though he's clearly the cat, you know, he made it what it is.
Well, just as we start to move away from discussing the character of Khan, a little anecdote. If you think Cumberbatch was miscast as a potentially Indian character or Montalban for the same, then you haven't seen Ricardo Montalban in the original Hawaii Five-O, where they slap some prosthetic on his eyes, and he is he's playing a 100% Japanese character, and it's just you're just watching it going. I mean, granted, you know that's the time. What like late. Late 60s, like, it, you know, they weren't being racist, but you watch it now and you just go, oh my goodness, that is a Mexican man with bad rubber on his eyes. This is offensive. I want to turn it off. what is going on?
Right. So, you know, for a Hispanic gentleman to be playing, you know, an Eastern Indian at that time, you know, that was something that went on. So, you know, that's where, you know, the outcry over, you know, Cumberbatch playing Khan really, I think, falls on deaf ears because of the way it was originally handled.
Yeah.
So if you could do it originally, and that for me made it more palatable. And I was really worried, like, how am I going to react? You know, and again, being Spoiler Pete and all, you know, hashtag Spoiler Pete, you know, reading everything I could, you know, once the film had screened in Australia in its entirety for the first time publicly, and knowing right away, all right, they went to Khan as we really, you know, had the idea that they would. Otherwise, why be coy about it? You know, it made it far more acceptable for me in light of the way it was handled the first time. But the whole backstory of the eugenics wars and everything that's teased out in the newer film, you know, this idea that, you know, they led nations and that they were genetically engineered, and it's the anti Roddenberry.
It absolutely is, and perhaps in a way that that many other episodes don't quite touch or don't quite confront the view that Gene Roddenberry had, because you do have, you know, you have a starship. Even to return back to MacGyver's for a minute, there's kind of, you know, Kirk is a little dismissive, you know, oh, let's put that historian that we have to work. Like, it's right. That's just an excuse to explain, you know, her position and why you've never seen her before on a mission.
Well, dude, let's be honest. You know, Kirk can't say, let's get a skirt up here. You know? but that's the subtext.
But, I mean, my point was only that it is a future where, darn it, if your thing is studying history from 300 years ago, there's a place for you in the space service. Like, you know, there's a place for you in the world. It's not just kind of, you know, you're going to make ships and bottles or that kind of thing. There's a place for you out there on the frontier, on the cutting edge, the same as there are for, you know, space mechanics and spaceship drivers and everybody. Everybody kind of has that, everybody's potential can be maximized. And everybody has great potential is the Gene Roddenberry view, whereas the Khan view is potential is this fixed, innate thing. You start out life with, you know, X number of smarty pants points or strength exactly. points or whatever. And
the smarty points gene. The smarty pants gene, I'm sorry.
the super heart gene that pumps twice as much in one pump as I believe McCoy says. So, you know, we kind of see, you know, we see that in Khan. That's kind of the subtext. And, you know, the way the episode ends, which you want to talk about prescient, you know, where Kirk is basically looking at the camera going, I wonder what would happen if we looked in on this story in the future. Now, granted, he says 100 years and, you know, it's less than that. But just it's funny how it ends, but notice that as awful as Khan is presented to be, product of the eugenics wars, you know, going against our beloved heroes and all that, it does kind of end with this hope of, you know what, if you don't have the supermen versus the normal men, and you just stick the supermen on a perfectly fine planet, the gee whiz will never have anything happen to it, what are they going to do? Like, can they breed the fight out of themselves? Can they drop that fight against the inferior people when it's just a bunch of them? What kind of society are they going to make? It kind of ends on that hopeless note nonetheless.
Well, brings up several things, you know, I want to address. One, Kirk, from the foil perspective, clearly admires Khan and his abilities. And you can see that. There's a gleam in his eye that, you know, he respects what this guy is capable of. It's not a fear, because Kirk never shows you fear. But there's that admiration of, well, you know, I can't destroy it honors Roddenberry's principles. I can't destroy what's been created. I can make the best of what already exists. So often did Star Trek go down the Aryan master race route within the original series. You know, we have the ones where they wind up on the planet full of Nazis. You know, it's referenced several times throughout the original series. You can go into Enterprise, where one of the cliffhangers, season three into season four, literally the Nazis won World War II, and there's a whole thing there with a resistance in Brooklyn, okay, and everything going on there.
There's the Jem'Hadar in Deep Space Nine who you know, are the Supermen soldiers. They've been bred to be just that way.
Exactly. And here, this was a more benign way than to harken back, you know, 21 years and say, well, it's basically it's Space Hitler, you know. Instead, we bring it out of a vile, the blonde-haired, blue-eyed ideal. Instead, you know, we're talking about a man from India and everything that he stood for and the way he's able to do this. And then when they get to the tribunal at the end and that Kirk lets him live, which watching for the first time, and again, you know, I had seen Star Trek II before I had seen this episode. And then you go back, you know, and watch this one, as was consistent with my upbringing. You know, being a man of almost 38 years old, I wasn't old enough. I wasn't alive when the original series came on. But, you know, to go back and watch this and you're like, why did he let him live? And then, you know, when they combed through all the original series episodes with, you know, what's a narrative strand that we can follow up on, no wonder they were attracted like the audience was to Spacey and to Khan and making him so worthy a villain. And, you know, I think that temptation again came up with, well, what do we do at the end of this most recent movie? And, you know, again, spoiler Pete, they let him live. And again, consistent with those ideals. Now, I think a lot of that was going back to the original and, well, he didn't kill him in the original series. He shouldn't kill him here. Yes, we're doing a movie, but we're doing it at a much earlier stage. And, you know, the guy had a breakout performance, too. Had this been Benicio del Toro, as they were in discussions to originally bring in, who would have been a Hispanic man playing a Northern Indian, then, you know, and a much older man than Chris Pine's Captain Kirk, I think it might have been a different story. I think that might have influenced the way that the story ultimately went. But, you know, the whole thing here with the Superman ideal and eugenics, which is something that, you know, all right, we didn't deal with it in the 1990s. We didn't have wars of, you know, genetically engineered soldiers as they posited we might, you know, in the mid 60s. But, you know, look at what we can do now. And where's that ultimately going? You know, will we one day say, well, I want a blonde haired, blue eyed kid? You know, oh, and by the way, you know, I want him to play lacrosse and X, Y, and Z. You know, it teases the best of us with the possible worst intentions.
Well, and, you know, there's kind of another contrast to Gene Roddenberry's view of where humanity can go, because here we have this episode airing a scant 22 years after, you know, the greatest of wars, the most deadliest of wars. And in the background of the story, but there nonetheless, or at least in the background for when you watched it. Now it's a little bit of a, you know, tee-hee type thing, but you have this tremendously much worse war of these eugenics wars, plural, in the 1990s, not kind of some even understandable, you know, there were bad guys. You know, World War II is kind of, most people are quite comfortable saying there were the bad guys and the good guys fought because they needed to, and the good guys won at great cost, but an acceptable cost to protect our way of life and the world and everything. Here you have the eugenics wars, which are introduced as the beginning of what Spock calls another dark age.
Right.
And just kind of this notion that, hey, we have 20, 22 years behind us, we have an awful war, and a certain percentage of your audience watching grew up during it, perhaps served in it. And certainly it's a strong cultural memory in February 1967 when this episode aired. And then you're saying, and in those 22 years, yes, there's the Iron Curtain. Yes, there's the Cold War. Yes, there's the Korean War. Obviously, we have Vietnam heating up, but it's not the world at war type feeling. And what are we saying? We're saying, and in about the same amount of time, a bit more, but in about another 22 or 25 years, it's going to get tremendously worse. And it will get better at the other side. We are going to have, you know, multicultural, equal, roughly equal gender, traveling the stars. We're going to have all these adventures in 300 years, but congrats, you're 22 watching this episode. You were born at the end of World War II when Dad came home and so on and so forth. And you might not live to be a grandparent, says this view of the future, because these awful wars are coming to just lay ravage. You know, Spock says, I believe it's, what's the line? Whole populations or whole cities were wiped off the face of the earth.
Right.
I mean, it's just this horrific where you sit and say, you know, all right, two atomic bombs in the history of the planet. By the time you get to 1967, you've had 22 years where it was done twice in 1 month at the end of the war. Seems like things are better. But then you're saying, no, it's going to be far, far worse. It's not going to be some kind of foreign enemy that we don't quite understand. It could be your city that you're watching, that you're watching from. So just a tremendous kind of a downer view of the then future, which of course is our past back then,
right?
Back now, whatever, you know, a little confusing, but just a stunning notion to think that it wasn't out of line in 1967 to say, yeah, about 25 years from now will be a low point of humanity, equal to the Dark Ages. It will be another Dark Ages, except it won't be, you know, germs that kill people. It'll be people who kill people on a massive scale.
Like germs.
Well, yes, like germs, but in that the germs, you know, the bubonic plague was passive in its, you know, it was just doing its thing as a creature. There was no bubonic plague general pushing a button saying, you know, goodbye, Austin, Texas. Goodbye, well, Shanghai.
The idea, too, that they, you know, they wiped out populations because they didn't meet an ideal, you know,
yeah.
that they were conquistadors. They were, you know, deciding the future of, you know, entire populations based on what the population was, you know. And in light of, I don't know, racial problems in 2013, I think it's at the very least a salient discussion to think, well, if the technology could eventually exist, then who's to say some madman or madmen might not try to distort it for their own aims?
Well, Pete, you clearly are taking Khan's side. What about a mad woman?
Well, that too, man. When I said men, I meant, you know, man in general.
Indeed, humanity.
Let's from pondering the highest of highs and lowest of lows, let's go. You know, one of the things that, you know, listeners of this podcast and the PH Geek family with a PH of podcast will note is that we keep it real. And, you know, if it's good, we're going to praise it. If it's bad, we're going to let you know about it. Matt, what did you think of the climactic battle in Main Engineering between Khan and Kirk?
Definitely a little rough around the edges. A little, you know, let's do the big wide shot here. Let's do, you know, let's get the actors in for the close up, that kind of thing. I'd say, you know, as with so much of the original series, You give a loving pass to some of the rough edges, if only because underfunded show, misunderstood show, you know, all that we've kind of come to romanticize about the show. Also, just simply a different time. Did they know that they, you know, there literally were people watching this episode with black and white televisions, right, and on an antenna. It's not, you know, 51-inch screen TV, 1080p HD, pause and go, oh, is that a wig on a stuntman? Oh, is that guy has a different hair color than Bill Shatner.
And a different build.
And a different build. So
all I can say is thank God that even though Khan had the leg up with all his genetically engineered intelligence and strength, thank God Kirk had the benefit of knowing the layout of main engineering and knowing that one of the paper towel dispensers could be pulled off and he could beat Khan unconscious with it.
I mean, Pete, that's probably just... They probably go over that in kind of, you know, engineering for non-engineers at the Academy. You know, they say, here's the breakaway. You know, they probably reference From Russia with Love. And then they say, you know, here's the breakaway paper towel dispenser that also is a, you know, is a steel tube that you could beat an assailant with. And that kind of thing. You know, I mean, let's not forget the Gene Roddenberry's Earth. You know, it's almost a hippy dippy place where it's like, what? Somebody might try and come into main engineering and blow the ship up? I just thought that if somebody came into main engineering, they wanted to, like, get a tour.
Yeah.
So, you know, they need to shock these cadets into being able to you know, exist out there in the big bad realms of space.
Use random parts of the ship to beat vastly superior physical specimens into submission.
Sounds like a Kobayashi Maru to me. So with that, Pete, let's kind of start to summarize here. What is it for you that makes this episode a Star Trek essential?
The setup and the follow through. The middle, I'm not going to lie, sags a little bit. The whole, and again, you know, I'm drawn to echoes of the most recent film. The whole, you know, we're going to put Kirk in the airlock and deprive him oxygen and everything, you know. That's why I feel the newest movie is a very, very clear homage to what had come before and then, you know, been altered for today's sensibilities and today's audience. But the middle clearly sags, you know, from the Khan is going to pretend he's asleep to having the naivete to have basically every technical detail available about the ship for anyone at any time, despite the risk they might present, to the complete lack of records for an era.
Well, that. Now hang on. To be fair, they explain away the lack of records. Whether you want to accept the explanation, I don't know, but they go out of their way to say things were so chaotic that, I mean, look, you literally have cities being blown off the face of the earth. The registry, the background for one ship, albeit, you know, a very advanced ship for the time.
Right.
The show addresses that square on and, you know, and kind of posits, at least by implication, you know, that the record building for this might have been in any one of 5 or 10 cities that were completely destroyed.
And it's also a tool of the writer. And I get that and I understand that and I accept that. It still doesn't help, you know, that being a major hole in, you know, what's going on there when you consider, too, that it's only 300 years. But, you know, it's a small qualm in the course of the larger story. You know, the true highlight in the middle of the episode is the dinner that they have. And again, the verbal tete-a-tete that Kirk and Khan go through. And then ultimately, you know, Kirk allowing him to live and sending him off. And, you know, the episode's title is perfect in that, you know, we're going to plant this seed and we'll see ultimately what will sprout, something positive or something demented. And, you know, obviously the next narrative with Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, you know, shows you how obviously the potential was not squandered, but spoiled.
Pete, this is SETI Alpha 5.
No, this is Star Trek Essentials.
I'm sure our listeners get the reference. Pete, I mean, I certainly agree with everything that you said there. It's the fact that we've been able to get so much from our time, no kind of pun intended for this episode, which is not exactly time travel, but you know, it's a little time bendy, and it's a, you know, man from the past, which is the future for the show when it was aired, you know, and all that. But the fact that we can get so much out of it certainly is proof that that it remains incredibly vibrant. The fact that it was a source for Star Trek Into Darkness speaks to that as well. And I'll just add on a personal note, Lieutenant Marla McGivers, she is okay in my book.
Especially when she fixes her hair like Khan likes it.
Absolutely. On that highbrow note, let's look ahead to next week. Pete, we will be doing a commentary track for the animated series episode Yesteryear. That's episode 102. And I'm looking forward to sitting down and watching that with you and the listeners.
Definitely.
Now, with that, Pete, I know that, as is the case with you know, some of our previous podcasts and certainly the PH Geek Pop Culture podcast running concurrent to this, Pete, you get quite a fan following. So if a fan wants to reach out and say hello, how can they say hello to you on Twitter?
You can find me on Twitter at Peter, P-I-E-T-E-R, J, Ketelaar, K-E-T-E-L-A-A-R.
And if you'd like to say hi to me on Twitter, I am Looking Back Lost. With that, Pete, I guess we have come to the end of this episode. I can't wait to get together again next week for our episode 102, which is also episode 102 of the animated series Yesteryear. And I will say, live long and prosper to one and all. And Pete, you can conclude with one of your famous ending lines.
Gone!